I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
This episode of The American Idea. Today we're going to be talking about a fascinating figure and a terrific book bringing back to light this fascinating figure from American history, someone who deserves an important place in our pantheon, but for too many people, they don't know him. They don't know his importance. That's why we're having the conversation today with Caleb Franz. Caleb is a writer, podcaster, commentator on public affairs. He's been published widely in the national media. He's also a program manager for Young Voices. Caleb, thanks for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Thank you so much, Jeff. I'm excited for this conversation.
The book, your book, is called The Conductor, the story of Reverend John Rankin, abolitionism's essential founding father. All right. I think a lot of people, in fact, I confess that I only knew of him obliquely by connection to people like William Lloyd Garrison, prominent 19th century American abolitionist, Frederick Douglass, another prominent 19th century American abolitionist. And until looking at your book, did not really understand who Rankin was and why he's so important that some people thought of him as the George Washington of the anti-slavery movement. Who was Reverend John Rankin?
Well, I would say that your observation is probably more informed than most people who would come across the name of John Rankin. He's not a household name by any means. And that is, I think, a real shame, because he really is, for all intents and purposes, someone that we can consider one of, if not the most important father figures of the American abolitionist movement as we understand it today. And of course, that's not to say that he's the first one to ever conceive of the idea of abolition, or he's not the first one to speak out against slavery. But his words and his ideas, particularly as we'll, I'm sure, get into more in depth here in just a moment, around his letters on American slavery. These letters kind of became a textbook of sorts. I compare them in my book and various other works that I've written on this, similar to the way that the Federalist Papers made the case for the Constitution. Rankin's letters on American slavery did a very similar job for the abolition movement and for the case of immediate abolitionism. At the time, concepts such as colonization or forms of gradual emancipation were kind of the accepted path forward when dealing with slavery, from even among anti-slavery advocates. The idea of ending slavery or emancipating slaves in the South immediately was viewed as kind of radical and not something that people were really willing to adopt or accept very quickly. People were fearful of slave rebellions, as they had seen in Haiti and also in the United States, such as Gabriel's Rebellion around 1800, Nat Turner's Rebellion later on in the 1830s. These were lingering in the back of people's minds, but Rankin rather kind of shifted the perspective on this issue, where he looked at slavery itself as the cause of these rebellions that was happening. And thus, if we want to ensure that both the harmony of the United States and the peace and security of the United States, as well as fulfilling the original ideas of the United States was fulfilled, then the issue has to come down to ending slavery.
Let's talk about John Rankin himself. What for our listeners who don't know much about him, what were his dates? When was he born? Where was he born? Where did he live?
So John Rankin was born in 1793. February 4th is his birthday. It was actually the same day that Congress passed the in the House passed the original fugitive slave law. So ever since the very beginning of his story, it seemed like he was tethered to slavery and its eventual abolition. He lived all the way through 1886. So a good 93 years that he was alive for. He never, of course, he frequented places like New York City, Washington, D.C., where a lot of the activities took place, especially once he got involved in the American anti-slavery movement. But he never lived in any of those major metropolitan areas that so many of his other colleagues did, which I think contributes to why we don't know as much about Rankin as, or have not heard as much about Rankin as much as other figures like Garrison, as you mentioned. He grew up in Eastern Tennessee, so he was from the South, which does also is another point of interest, I think, where he's a little bit different from some of the more New England centric abolitionists that took place. And I think that that does contribute a lot to his authority in the movement and his respectability in the movement, because he wasn't someone who was geographically removed from the situation, being able to kind of talk about a situation that they really had never experienced or didn't really know as much about. Rankin grew up with slavery all around him. And in fact, slavery was the reason why he was kind of forced out of Tennessee and forced to move to free soil in Ohio. Throughout most of his life, he lived in Ripley, Ohio, which is where the bulk of the story in my book and The Conductor takes place. And Ripley is this incredible place. It's still to this day very much very similar to the way it was when John Rankin was alive. It's a very small community, a village essentially. And his house, which was aptly dubbed, I think, Liberty Hill, is a place that sits on the hill right behind the community of Ripley. It's the only structure on the hill right now. There used to be a barn that was his as well, that was there, that was burned down. But today, even, you can see how it's the only structure, and anyone fleeing from slavery would be able to identify that house as he put a lantern in his window for those on the Underground Railroad to pursue.
So I think a lot of our listeners will be fascinated by the fact and raise the question naturally, how does a guy from who's raised, born or raised in Eastern Tennessee come by anti-slavery principles and sentiments?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So Eastern Tennessee was a little bit more, I would say, a little bit more favorable or a little bit more sympathetic to anti-slavery ideas. A lot of the people in the mountains were a little bit more toward the abolitionist wing. That's not to say everyone was, obviously, but and his mother was really the driving force of his anti-slavery thoughts. And of course, there were a series of incidences or a series of events throughout his upbringing that contributed to that anti-slavery thought. The one was Gabriel's Rebellion, as I mentioned, a slave uprising in Virginia during the Monroe governorship administration. Another one was the Second Great Awakening. Now, the Second Great Awakening was taking place, I believe he was about 9 or 10, and maybe a little bit younger, around the time that it was starting to sweep through Kentucky and Tennessee. And he always grew up in a Calvinistic household. Religion was something that was very important to him. And the events and the kind of emotionalism that was sweeping through the Second Great Awakening really gave him a lot of perspective on the importance of theology and the importance of making sure that that truth is anchored in reality, and not just something that a charismatic preacher might be able to say. That kind of, you start to see that influence his views on slavery, because so many people in the South would utilize scripture to justify their own slaveholding, which is something that Rankin particularly took offense to as he was going through his anti-slavery years.
And it's fairly remarkable, as you note in the book, these letters on American slavery are highly literate, very polished, eloquent, persuasive pieces. Of course, they're written for common consumption as well. They're not theoretical treatises. But how does a person raised in rural Tennessee, who is forced out and has to move to southern Ohio, how does a person like that get an education? And did his education have any effect on his abolitionism?
So his education was admittedly limited. He did go to college. It was in Washington College near Jonesboro, Tennessee. But he almost even had to drop out because funding from his family was becoming very thin. And in fact, it wasn't until the death of his brother, David, that he was able to continue that funding after they received compensation from the government. At Washington College, he met a man named Samuel Doak. Now, he was a reverend. He studied under he studied at what is now Princeton under the tutelage of John Witherspoon. And he was someone that really was kind of a pioneer in a literal sense, but also pioneer in bringing education out west. He also was the grandfather of the woman that he would soon make his wife, Jean. And Jean was an incredible, incredible woman. She appears in the story that I write sparingly, but the instances that she does appear, they're very important occasions. And I think there was a lot of intuition on John Rankin's part. You know, he grew up in a household that valued education, despite being in an area that didn't really take it all that seriously. There's a lot of comical references in his autobiography about how people didn't take to what they called learning very, very well throughout Eastern Tennessee. But his father, Richard, he was a self-educated man, and he always emphasized reading in his house, especially reading scriptures and especially reading history. And I think those combinations, despite the fact that he had a limited education in a literal sense, it did contribute to his literacy and just the way that he looked at the world broadly.
And as you, of course, note in the book, himself, a minister, tell us about once he moves to Ohio. When does he move to Ohio? When does he establish himself in Ripley? And tell us about the beginnings of his ministerial career and its connection to abolitionism.
So he moves to Ripley in 1822. It's actually New Year's Day, 1822, that he crosses the Ohio River. When he walks into Ripley, it's not a welcoming place for either an abolitionist or a minister, let alone an abolitionist minister. There's a lot that he has to kind of try to overcome during this time, and largely his ministry is something that I think a lot of people in the area really looked up to, because I kind of compare Ripley at this time to an old prototype saloon town of the West. There were shootouts on the streets, there were muddy brawls, whiskey, you know, fueled fights, and there were more taverns than there were churches. And again, you know, at this time in the Western frontier, religion was not something that we take for granted nearly as much as it is today. It was something that a lot of people valued once they got a hold of it, but actually getting it to them was complicated. So Rankin had an uphill battle. But easily the most challenging episode in those early years in Ripley did come, as I alluded to earlier, in December of 1823, when his brother Thomas wrote to him about purchasing slaves and becoming a slaveholder. This was really where I think the rubber meets the road for everything that Rankin was preparing for throughout his life. You know, he believed that God was calling him to go out and become a minister and utilize his ministry against slavery. You can see that all throughout his writings, both at the time as well as his reflections in his autobiographies later in life. This is where I think that that became a reality, because his own flesh and blood is the sort of catalyst for this fight. And it's not something that he expected. And he started to wonder, well, if my own flesh and blood would fall prey to these arguments and justify himself becoming a slaveholder, then what hope was there to defeat slavery outright? So in his mind, these arguments could not just be limited to his brother. He had to take this and make it much more public. And that's exactly what he did between the years of 1824 and 1825. He started a public letter campaign where he tried to address every possible argument that he could that was made in favor of slavery and offering a rebuttal. And these letters became a sensation up and down the Ohio River, not without controversy, of course. But they did sweep the region, and they did eventually have their intended effect of getting Thomas to rid himself of slavery.
I think a lot of our listeners might think, well, all right, so he crosses from a slave state to a free state. It's probably an anti-slavery area. His abolitionism is probably well received. It's probably embraced publicly. Is that true?
No, it's definitely not true. He was, of course, it should be said that he did find a community, which I think really helps us understand how he was so influential and how he was so successful. But he also met significant opposition, especially as his name rose and notoriety. Mobs would constantly form around him as he was going around speaking against slavery in southern Ohio. Of course, being right there on the Ohio River, there were plenty of pro-slavery advocates sympathizers in that region, even though it was in a free soil, so to speak. He had eggs thrown at him, rotten eggs and rocks. And eventually it would get to the point where whenever he would go and speak against slavery, he would start to park his horse on the other side of town so that the mobs wouldn't shave his horse and bob its tail. It was very dangerous and very risky. And eventually it got to the point where there were bounties that were starting to be put on his head, not just for his words, obviously, his activities on the Underground Railroad contributed to that significantly, but he was just as much despised as he was loved. And I think that really is a testament to his own personal integrity and his own understanding of the mission that he had set out before him, because he never left Ripley. It was never really a question for him to move further north where it might be safer, say in the Western Reserve or in New England, where you're geographically removed from slavery. He knew that this was where his fight was, and he wasn't going to give that battle up.
Of course, by the 1830s, abolitionism starts to grow. We have the founding of the American Anti-Slavery Society, William Lloyd Garrison's Liberator. Anti-abolition seems to become more public. How does Ripley's role in the movement grow, including, as you just mentioned, his role in the Underground Railroad?
Well, Ripley sort of becomes a hub for the Underground Railroad. It is one of the most active locations for this entire movement. Of course, you have places like Cincinnati, just down the river, that provide additional support. But really, for its size, I don't know of any city or any location that had as big of an impact as much as Ripley did. Through Rankin's station at his home, of course, whenever someone would cross the river in pursuit of freedom up to Canada, they would come at various points, but largely they were funneled through Rankin's house. And over 2,000 people were eventually making their way through Rankin's station.
2,000 people.
2,000 people. I think. Obviously is a big number in its own right, but just for comparison, Harriet Beecher Stowe, I believe, was in the seven, or excuse me, not Harriet Beecher Stowe, Harriet Tubman was around the 700, 750 range for how many people that she helped. And of course, the people in her stories are quite legendary. But for Rankin, his home station helped over 2,000 people escape.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to take a moment and ask you to learn a little more about the Ashbrook Center and how you can help us continue our work with teachers, students, and citizens.
I'm Chad Kiefer, Director of Philanthropy and Strategic Partnerships here at Ashbrook. At its heart, America's story is about the lives of patriots who have given their last full measure of devotion to preserve and protect what it means to be an American. But the tragic truth is that the American story is being rewritten as one of oppression and despair. Back in 1776, the founders took a chance when they created a new government built on principles of liberty. They took a chance on America. Now I'm challenging you to do the same. Your gift to Ashbrook today reaches students, teachers, and citizens across the country, helping them to understand why America is worthy of their devotion. With so many forces eroding our history and taking away from our principles, isn't it time we give America a chance? Your investment is encouraged now more than ever. Please visit us today at ashbrook.org/support.
You mentioned Harry Beecher Stowe. Think of Uncle Tom's Cabin. The mention of the Underground Railroad. In that book, Quakers are featured in Ohio as being part of the Underground Railroad. Of course, they're famously anti-slavery. Tell us a little bit more about Rankin's role in the Underground Railroad. Would he be in communication, for example, with other Christian ministers, including Quaker communities? How was it set up?
Yeah, very much so. I think the most famous, at least in this part of the region, minister that he had contact with was a man named Levi Clothen, who was in Indiana. That was one of the next stops on the Underground Railroad from Rankin Station, one of the big stations stops on their journey up to Canada. Had a lot of different contacts with him. He eventually moved down to Cincinnati, and both Coffin and Rankin both were pretty influential to Harriet Beecher Stowe herself. Harriet Beecher Stowe got to know Rankin from very early days whenever they first moved to Cincinnati, the Beecher family. And one of the stories that Rankin retold to Stowe and her husband Calvin Stowe was a story that she later would adopt into Uncle Tom's Cabin. It's in fact one of the more sensational or one of the more dramatic episodes of that story, the character Eliza crossing the river. Now, of course, there's various details that she adjusts a little bit because the nature of the Underground Railroad is dangerous and obviously illegal. But that story was directly taken from a real life person that Rankin helped escape.
So during this time, I'm assuming now we're talking about the 1830s, 1840s, and into the 1850s. He's become such a prominent anti-slavery advocate. His home is such a hub, a station in the Underground Railroad. Legally, as you just said, it's illegal. How did he manage to pull it off? Would local legal authorities kind of look the other way? They knew what was going on. They wouldn't pursue it. Were there people running interference for him? Or how did he manage to avoid legal problems?
Well, this, I think, is one of the reasons, another reason why we don't know nearly as much about Rankin in a popular setting as much as we do about some people in New England or on the other side of the Appalachian Mountains, because there was a tremendous amount of secrecy that was going on, especially after 1850, after the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850, where they really clammed down on fugitive slaves and the Underground Railroad. He starts to instruct the conductors in the Ripley community to burn any evidence that they have. As you may be familiar with, Levi, or excuse me, not Levi, William Still and his reporting of the Underground Railroad and his note taking through that. There were several conductors in Ripley that was doing the same thing. John Parker, who was another black conductor in Ripley, Ohio, did this often. But at Rankin's recommendation, so to speak, they started to burn this evidence because any evidence that could tie them back not only endangered their own safety and put themselves at risk of either imprisonment or mobs and their lives were at risk, but also the entire operation of the Underground Railroad was at risk. If there was anything that could come back to them, then that would endanger the entire operation of trying to get everyone up to Canada safely. So there was a lot of secrecy and a lot of precautions that had to be taken, and Rankin was very aware of that danger.
Of course, all the folks involved in the Underground Railroad and the broader abolition movement, they agreed on the horror and evil of slavery, the injustice of slavery. But as many of our listeners know, and of course, I know you know, there's a lot of divisions in the abolitionist movement. It's not as though they were all united on everything. They might have all opposed slavery, but you had some who said, well, we have this scourge of slavery because the Constitution is an evil pro-slavery document. William Lloyd Garrison. You have others like Frederick Douglass saying, no, the Constitution is a great liberty document. Mm-hmm. You have some people saying we should engage in political struggle, not just the Underground Railroad and a physical help, but political struggle. Some saying, no, politics is dirty. We have no place in it. Some saying armed slave rebellions and resistance is permitted and right. Some saying absolutely not. Where did Rankin fall on those immediate controversial disputes in the abolitionist movement?
Rankin was surprisingly practical, I found, for despite his more radical approaches. He believed in the purity of principle, and whenever he is right, or whenever he believes himself to be right, he was not going to waver on those issues. That's why he advocated for immediate emancipation as opposed to gradual emancipation or colonization. But whenever he saw an opportunity, he did not want the great to become the enemy of the good, so to speak. And he really saw the outcome of ensuring that people were free as the North Star of anything that he was doing. So he did not want any sort of political divisions to lose sight of that eventual outcome, which I think a lot of, as you alluded to, a lot of the abolitionists at the time really did kind of get into the weeds of that. And it's abolition was not clean. It was a pretty messy process. And sometimes it meant making compromises in ways that wasn't as comfortable, such as voting for certain people that you didn't entirely support. In the election of 1840 with William Henry Harrison, this was a point of contention between him, Rankin, and his son, his firstborn son, Adam Lowry, who was an early defender and supporter of the Liberty Party, who was running James Birney at the time. Whereas Rankin was writing editorials in support of William Henry Harrison because he was more concerned with breaking the Jacksonian era and trying to make sure that era finally came to an end. So a little bit different priorities on that front, but it never really, his positions on those priorities never really impacted or affected the respect that the people in the abolition movement had for him, which I think is really something that speaks a lot to his character and speaks a lot to the way that people viewed him. And one of the reasons why I kind of allude to him being something of a George Washington type figure in the book is because he was that center of gravity for the abolitionists. Of course, just like Washington didn't always make decisions that made everyone happy at all times, but he was someone that everyone respected, regardless of what that decision ended up being.
Yeah, and one of the things that you note in the book, the George Washington analogy to me seems so helpful, because one of the things that kept people so connected to Washington was, as you alluded to, his unimpeachable character and integrity. And no one ever doubted that George Washington had the truest intentions and was most deeply attached to the principles of freedom and Republican government. Is that the same? Was that also true for Rankin? Did he earn the respect of abolitionists who disagreed with him because they knew how deeply he was truly devoted to the cause?
I believe so. Perhaps even to some degree more so than Washington, because the abolitionists did have, many of them had such a high regard. And I think the best example of this comes in a political convention that, an anti-slavery convention that takes place in 1853 in Cincinnati. And William Lloyd Garrison is there. And Garrison and Rankin start to get into this dispute. Now, some of the details of that dispute are a little muddled throughout history and a little bit lost throughout history. But there are some consistent themes, kind of the role of political abolitionism versus sort of more of a Garrisonian approach of non-involvement in politics. And various issues that Garrison became kind of prickly over, Rankin kind of had this battle, this ideological battle with him. But at the end of it, he wrote in a book leaflet, a message to Rankin and provided it for him. And it's a really great, I think, point of character, and it demonstrates Rankin's character and the reverence that they had, saying along the lines of, I don't have in front of me, but along the lines of, with the utmost veneration for my abolitionist or anti-slavery father, who I am a disciple of. And I think that despite the fact that Rankin and Garrison sometimes disagreed, the respect was never lost. And that's that sort of adoration, and the, it was almost like he felt indebted to Rankin for bringing him to abolition so early on. He considered him an anti-slavery father, and I think that was very represented throughout the abolitionist movement.
What about as we move through the 1850s and we get to 1860 and the outbreak of the Civil War? Telling about where does Rankin stand on the Republican Party, on Abraham Lincoln, and on the Civil War?
So this was a really interesting point in the book, because this was, I would say, easily the least amount of information or scholarship that had been done before I picked up this project, was easily around the Civil War. And that to me was curious, because this is the culmination of his entire life's work, finally being fulfilled. So I was able to find a few different editorials that he was able to put together. Largely, he stuck with writing throughout the Civil War. This, you know, he was older at this time, so there wasn't a lot physically he could do. Certainly not fight in the war. His sons largely did. Almost all of them fought in the Civil War for the Union. Some incredible battles as well during this time frame. But Rankin was very fixated on ensuring that the Civil War was an abolition war, basically from the outset. After the Battle of Bull Run, he picks up his pen and he starts to call out to the Lincoln administration in a public letter of sorts, and saying that slavery is the cause of the war, and we have to wage the war against slavery if we are going to effectively win in a broader context. Rankin believed that the war was providence. He had spent his entire life trying to avoid violent conflict. I think this stems back largely from the loss of his brother during the War of 1812. Whenever he died during the Battle of Horseshoe Bend, he hated violence and he hated state-sanctioned violence through war. But it came nonetheless, despite all of his best efforts, and he kind of viewed that as providence, saying that it's here and you have to wage it against slavery now that it's here. So he was very consistent throughout that. We see his reaction to the Emancipation Proclamation once that was issued. And even in the Emancipation Proclamation, he is telling his abolitionist brethren that it's good to celebrate this, but let's not lose sight on the ball. The object at hand is not yet finished, because Kentucky was not affected by the Emancipation Proclamation, which directly affected Rankin and other border states such as Missouri and Delaware and Maryland. The 13th Amendment was really the end of that road. And even then, after the 13th Amendment, he is focused still on what the next step is. He writes this incredible long letter in the Ripley Bee, which was the local paper, about just weeks after the ratification of the 13th Amendment, about there's still work to be done. There's still suffrage. There's still equal protection that needs to be addressed before we can truly say that we are a republic that respects the liberties of all people. And he writes this incredible letter about how we must become a nation of righteousness if we are to truly receive the blessings of the Creator.
And then, of course, our listeners would think he lives into 1886, as you said. So he Yes. lives in Reconstruction, through Reconstruction, and in some ways after Reconstruction. Is he still active publicly? And if he is, what are his views and positions on Reconstruction?
You know, he after slavery is defeated, I think that he kind of sees that as the final culmination of his life's work. And I do think that there is a bit of a passing of the torch to the next generation, because he is getting quite old at this time. And the only thing that he really ever wanted to do was be a preacher. So you see this reflected in the aftermath of the Civil War. He's not as involved. He's not as outspoken as he was in the buildup. That's not to say, as I alluded to in that letter, at the end of 1865, he's still very aware of the problems. But, you know, I kind of think of this a little bit in the sense of some of Jefferson's approach with his approach later on in life, to where he starts to understand, like, this, I can't fight this battle anymore. And it's going to be up to the next generation to complete this work. Rankin kind of has a similar mentality around that. He finally was able to defeat slavery, him and his fellow abolitionists. And now it's up to the younger generation to pick up the torch.
You've spent a lot of time in this book. Again, let me highly recommend this book to our listeners, The Conductor. But you've spent a lot of time with the Reverend John Rankin. You've gotten a chance to know him, his family, his cause, his thoughts. What do you take away from this? I think our listeners are always fascinating to know what an author takes away from engagement with such an interesting, deep, complex human being.
I believe that Rankin is one of the greatest American heroes. And I truly believe that. And it was something that I had always, you know, appreciated and valued John Rankin even before starting this book. But now it's abundantly clear, having written this, just what his place in American history should be. And I think that the more that people can spread his story, the better of an understanding that we'll have about how slavery was able to be defeated. It was not clean. It was not. It was very messy at times. But because of the integrity of his character, and because of his moral authority and his willingness to lead by example and not just by words, is an incredible example for us as we're navigating our own, you know, political conflicts and you know, risks of increasing violence in our own time. I think Rankin's story is incredibly timely, despite the fact that it is so old in so many ways. And I do think that Rankin's story also demonstrates, you know, in history, there is kind of an attitude that so much of the abolition movement took place largely the ancestors of the political left. And really, I think that the abolitionists were not a monolith in that sense. They had a lot of different perspectives on a lot of different issues, and slavery and the fight against slavery was the one thing that kind of conjoined them. But Rankin sort of demonstrates, and Frederick Douglass later on, as you alluded to, that they were not all opposed to the Constitution, and they were not all opposed to the American idea or the American experiment. And some of the values that the founders set forth, those were the first ones to really pick up that torch and to lead the country into a new era that would fully live out those founding ideas.
Well, it is a fascinating, engaging, wonderfully written book. American worthy of being studied, as you said, and being emulated. The book, again, is The Conductor, the story of Reverend John Rankin, abolitionism's essential founding father, by our guest, Caleb Franz. Caleb, thanks for taking the time to join us today on The American Idea.
Thank you so much, Jeff. This was great.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.